Welcome, everyone. My name is Erin Schaefer, and I'd like to welcome you to our final Women on Wednesday series for Spring 2012, Exploring and Making Visible Women's Intersecting Identities. This semester's series on women's intersecting identities has explored the rich layers of women's multiple identities and how these intersections shape their lived experiences and perceptions. A few items before we get started. Please turn off your cell phones and please stay seated until 12:50 as a courtesy to our speakers. If you could please fill out the evaluation forms, we use your feedback for future programming. Please note that following today's presentation, there will be a reception at the American Indian Center in commemoration of American Indian Awareness Week. Also, in honor of Sexual Assault Awareness Month, Heather Emery will present The Hookup, When It's Hot and When It's Not. Ms. Emery will educate about healthy relationships and healthy sexuality using humor and improv. Our session today is titled The Garden of Truth Report. Native women speak their truths. Our panelists will discuss a groundbreaking research report entitled Garden of Truth, the prostitution and trafficking of Native American women in Minnesota. Today's presentation is a commemoration of American Indian Awareness Week and National Sexual Assault Awareness Month, co-sponsored by the SCSU American Indian Center. Our panelists today are Nicole Matthews and Guadalupe Lopez. Nicole Matthews is a member of the White Earth Band of Ojibwe, and is the Executive Director for Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition. Prior to her director position, Matthews worked in Mille Lacs County, Minnesota as the Sexual Assault Service Coordinator for Pearl Crisis Center. She's spoken at numerous conferences on both the statewide and national levels about sexual violence and domestic assault. Matthews received her Bachelor's of Science degree from St. Cloud State University in Applied Psychology with a minor in Human Relations and Multicultural Education. Guadalupe Lopez is the Membership and Outreach Coordinator at the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition and a member of the Lake Ojibwe. She has been the Membership and Outreach Coordinator for nearly 2 years and is also a volunteer sexual assault advocate for sexual offense services in Ramsey County and Granite Falls. Prior to employment at the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition, Lopez worked for Women of Nations in St. Paul, advocating on behalf of battered women. We are very grateful to have them here with us today. Please join the Women's Center in welcoming Nicole Matthews and Guadalupe Lopez.
You want to use the mic? Yeah. Hello. Can you guys all hear me in the back? Okay, good. It's really nice to be here. I haven't been, I graduated from here, I'm Nicole Matthews, and I haven't been on campus for a really long time, so it's kind of fun to be back and see what has changed and what's a lot of what I remember. I used to work at the Women's Center also, so it's kind of fun coming back here. And we're really excited to share our research findings from the Garden of Truth report.
Hello, I'm Guadalupe. The bio needs to be updated. So I've been with MUSEC for 5 years now. So they kept me. No. So I am honored to be here. Like she said, I'm a member of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. And I was one of the four interviewers to conduct talking with our sisters being used in prostitution who've been trafficked. So I'm honored to be here.
So we're going to go through this. This is an hour and a half presentation that we're going to squeeze into 40 minutes so we can allow time for question and answer. So some of this we might go rather quickly, but feel free to ask questions, and we'd be happy to talk with anybody afterwards as well. These are our co-authors. Melissa Farley has done extensive research in many different countries on women's experiences being used in prostitution and trafficking. And so she was our principal researcher on this project, and we used some of her questionnaires so that we could compare the data and what we were learning about Native women in Minnesota to the information she had learned about women across the globe. Myself, Guadalupe, Sarah Deer is a law professor at William Mitchell College of Law and has been a longtime activist and working in Indian Country to end sexual violence. Christine Stark is an activist and a writer, and she's also a professor at Metro State University. And Eileen Houdon is a longtime activist. She's an elder and a personal friend and mentor of mine.
So we started to have discussions within our coalition. This is before I even started. Our coalition is 10 years old, and membership had seen what was happening in the urban areas. It looks different on tribal areas. We'll get into that a little bit later, but there was these discussions happening about our sisters being used in prostitution. We've seen it. We heard about it. Not much was being done other than prosecution of the women being used in prostitution. So we had that information. And we also know that Native women have high rates of sexual violence perpetrated against them, and multiple times. So the statistic that DOJ has is 1 in 3 Native women will be raped in her lifetime. And so that is a continuation on throughout her life. That's just not a one-time experience that we found out with this research, but then also just what I know being a Native woman talking to my own family and community members.
So these were some of the goals, the larger goals of this research was really to just to understand what was happening to Native women and to ask them about their needs. So as advocates, because we're a coalition of sexual assault advocates, so what we wanted to know was how can we provide the services? What do women need? How can we help them? How can we help them to get out of prostitution? What are the, you know, sometimes we think we know what people need, but until you actually sit down and have a conversation with someone, we found out that their needs were different than what we had initially thought.
So we had discussions on how are we going to do this research. We had to locate funding. We had to find out where in Minnesota, because we have 11 tribes in Minnesota. We, 4 Dakota and the remainder, or Anishinaabe or Ojibwe. What do we do? Where do we have that? Those interviews at, and be strategic about it. And then pulling together our research team, who will be a part of this, and how are we going to access the survivors of prostitution, and what does that look like? And so it was a process that looked different with, while we chose Duluth, Minnesota, St. Paul, Minneapolis area, and Bemidji, because Bemidji is surrounded by Red Lake, White Earth, and Leech Lake. That was kind of like the city hub for those three reservations. Duluth because of Fond du Lac, and then that's a major little city in Grand Portage and Boys Fort. And then we have a very high urban population here in St. Paul and Minneapolis, and so that's where we decided to have the interviews. And I have to say that we were currently at that time a small organization, and we had 3 staff that were full time, and Nicole and I are 2 of those staff, and so we volunteered to be the interviewers, and that took a lot of strength, personal strength, but it also took a lot of support within our coalition to support us, because we were kind of traumatized after hearing our sisters' stories and what they've gone through, and how to and listening to them, that it kind of made the rest of the coalition work seem not as important as, like, how do we help our sisters and how do we, you know, change our environment for them.
I also want to say that working in tribal communities, one thing that we were really aware of in the very beginning was that many people come to our communities, they do research that may or may not be helpful or useful to our communities, and then they leave and take it with them, and there's no services or there's no follow-up to that. And so we wanted to be really careful that we did not perpetuate that. And so we worked together to draft a resolution, and actually Guadalupe presented it to our tribal leadership through the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council to pass a resolution to support this project and to let our tribal leadership know that this is what we were requesting permission to do. And we got unanimous support from all the tribes in Minnesota. So we interviewed 105 Native women in Minnesota. Like I said, we used some of Melissa Farley's questionnaires, including a more general questionnaire about women's experience being used in prostitution. One was on chronic health issues. One was on dissociation and a PTSD screening. And then we created our own culturally specific questionnaire because we wanted to know things like, were they ever placed in out-of-home placement? Were they in foster care? If they were in foster care, was the foster family native or non-native? Were they abused in foster care? Were they ever adopted? And then again, asking those same questions about the adoptive family. We wanted to know about a family history of boarding schools. So did they have family members that attended boarding schools? Where? What boarding schools? Were they abused? How were they abused? And we asked questions about the race of not only the men buying Native women, but the men selling Native women. The questionnaires, the interviews took anywhere from an hour and a half to 3 hours in length. So you can imagine the stories that we heard in a 3 hour long interview. And and when Guadalupe says the trauma that all of us experienced, I think none of us had really been prepared to really have that sort of, have it affect us in the way it did. And it certainly made mundane things around when I went home seem really minor in comparison to the fact that we have our sisters that are dying.
I also wanted to add that is the power of this kind of violence that we all live in with every day. It's so strong that it tends to affect that ripple effect. Just because it happened to one person does not mean that you here in St. Cloud do not feel the effects of it in some way. You might not know exactly what it is, but it's like those, I consider it myself as like this community grooming of like what is okay, how to treat women. Is it okay for men to buy women used in prostitution? Is it okay for pornography? Is it okay for strip clubs? And we were all groomed coming up as children in some way or in society that these things are okay, because we didn't know the effects of it until you literally talk to somebody about what was it like to be used in prostitution? What is it like, you know, to be used at to be an exotic dancer, you know, but really that's a form of prostitution too, which before this, I did not connect those together, so.
We also wanted to make sure that that we honored these women and their stories, and that these women were not just a number to us on a file, because one of the reasons why I chose to have a degree in applied psychology as opposed to psychology was that I never, ever wanted to do research. And so coming at it from that perspective and never wanting to feel like this is a human subject and I have to put a number on it, that was really, these are my sisters. I sat in a room and looked and talked to someone who had many of the same experiences I had growing up, who grew up a lot the same, who I went to some of those parties too. I had a lot of those same stories I could have shared. And so we decided that we would, they would choose a flower name. So we came with a list, and they would pick a flower name, and that was their identifier throughout this process. And so you'll see at the top here, these are their names. In our report, the Garden of Truth has all of their names on the report, and that's the Garden of Truth. We really wanted to honor them and their stories throughout this process and really convey to them that they're much more than a number to us.
Willie, just big. So in order to, as an Ojibwe woman whose mother went to boarding school, who never lived on my reservation, who never knew my own language, was really disconnected from my own culture, I'm starting to learn as an adult of who we were as Native people. And when I heard within the last 10 years that in many of our tribal languages, if all, we don't have the word for rape. And when I brought that up to another group of people, they were saying, why, is it because it was just normal for you? And no, it wasn't. It was not normal to treat women in such a way, because we were considered sacred. Children and women were considered sacred because we were life givers. We are the only ones on the earth that can hold a child within our womb, who can produce her own water to feed that child from her own body. And so it was recognized with that. We were recognized as that. And then children being the closest to the Creator. So I think that is really important. Also, hearing, like looking back at records and of that first contact of what happened and things being written about kind of trying to take the indigenous people where they the first contact happened and trying to put them into brothels or trying to take them. Those are stories that are written in a lot of old books and whatever, but this is things that we've never passed, so then we have like all this repeated trauma, and it just gets relayed different if at all.
This is one of the quotes from the women that I think really summed this up well. Was that my culture doesn't put you around drugs or alcohol. It teaches you different values. It gives you belonging and faith. And we tried to really be, to include the quotes from the women in here because it was an honor for us to meet them and we're honored to share their stories. And I just want to make sure that their voice comes through. I'm going to go through past this quickly because you want to cover that.
So the women were between the age of 18 and 60 of who we interviewed. So, and the years in prostitution, 14 years. I think that the last bullet, the 57% of family members used in prostitution, that's really high. That's, I mean, speaking with them and hearing their story of like, well, this is something that we had to do because for whatever reason, it was never because it was introduced as this like independent sexual choice or it was a job. It was a survival. It was, well, how else was I supposed to feed my kids? How else was I supposed to get here? How, you know, or if I didn't sleep with this person, then I, you know, my rent could get jacked up. Whatever those stories were, there were so many different stories. There were so many different scenarios, and there was so many different entry points into prostitution for every single one of the 105 women. And so that's how complex it is.
So these are some of the things that maybe risk factors that brought this woman to this experience. 79% of the women that we interviewed had been sexually abused as a child by an average of 4 perpetrators. So we're not talking about a one-time incident. We're not even talking about one perpetrator. We're talking about 4 perpetrators on average for these women that had been, 79% of the women. And I'm guessing the number was a little higher because I think that many of the women didn't necessarily know if they could trust us with that information. And so my guess is there are women that had this experience but didn't want to share it with us.
When we did have those discussions with them, when we came to this question, this was the hardest for them to talk about. This was the hardest where they would either shut down and cry or didn't want, or just said move on, because we gave them that choice. They didn't have to answer anything that they didn't want to answer. That's why we recognize of the gift that they gave us by telling us their stories and to share that piece. So I think that is a really important thing. And if you've never received help as a child, how does that make you walk throughout the rest of your life?
One woman, when one of the interviewers asked how she got into prostitution, said, "I didn't get into prostitution. My dad sold us when I was 4 years old." So these are the types of stories we were hearing.
So I think boarding schools for any, not just regarding prostitution and trafficking, but regarding anything of us as Native people, have really devastated and changed who we are and how we walk right now. Can we get it back to who we were and what we are? Everybody's trying at different levels. Whether that's retaining our language, practicing our culture, being proud, even just the fact of being proud of being Native. Here is a picture of Carlisle Indian School. And so all of these children have been taken away from their homes and forced to assimilate into the mainstream Western society. So I think with boarding schools, what it did is it took away our language, which then attached to our life ways of how we perceived ourselves as women, our roles as women, and our roles as men, and also disconnected us as who we were as parents. If we were not raised by parents, how do we parent in a loving way? There was reports of sexual abuse at boarding schools. There was reports of physical abuse, and of course, spiritual abuse because of the most of the it was under a Catholic control in that kind of way.
And 62% of the women, when we asked them if they saw a connection between the colonization of Native people and the prostitution and trafficking of Native women, 62% of them said they did see a connection, but many of them had a difficult time articulating what it was. Like, you can feel it right here, but it's hard to give words to it. Can we talk about that?
So 48% of the women had been placed in foster care, and they had an average of five foster homes that they lived in. And some of them were good memories, some of them weren't good memories. 46 of them stated that they were abused in foster care. And when asked, like, why do you remember why, you know, what that transpired? So now we're talking about a generation that went to boarding school that, you know, did they ever receive help? Did they ever get to talk about it? Did they ever seek any kind of healing, spiritual, emotional, physical, you know, from their experiences, and then get placed back into the family in their culture, and now they don't fit? So we have a lot of people who were like, and my mom was one of them, where she was so embarrassed to be Native American that she went into the Mexican community and learned Spanish and fit in with them, because being Mexican at the time where she was growing up in Fargo, North Dakota, was a lot better than being Indian. And how that changed. And if I ever talked to her about that piece, she would shut down and say, oh, I don't remember. But you could tell. You could tell her energy said it, that she was embarrassed. Something happened because she wanted to cry every time I talked about it. So it was hard for her. And we are continuing to take away our children in Native homes. We have a really high rate. Lots of communities of color have high rates of children being taken out of the homes.
In addition, five of the women that we interviewed were adopted, and all of them reported being abused in some way in those foster homes or in those adoption families. Another thing we asked about was their connection to the criminal justice system, because we know that oftentimes we get caught in a system, in a criminal justice system, that is really hard to get out of. And once we have a record, it limits our access to a lot of things. It limits our access to education. It limits our access to housing. It limits our access to economic stability. It's hard to get a job. So we wanted to find out how women were entering the criminal justice system. Were they entering as juveniles or as adults? And what really got the ball rolling to get them caught up in that system. So about half of the women were arrested as minors an average of 8 times. And it was offenses such as truancy, theft, and it started that cycle of getting caught up in a system that is very difficult to get out of. And in addition, several had been arrested for prostitution, which, if you think about that in your mind, prostitution as children, and when I hear the term, I always cringe when they talk about child prostitutes, because we're talking about child sexual abuse. It is ludicrous to think that we're calling it child prostitution when they're children, and these are adults that are preying on our children.
And thinking about the cycle, if that many of our women reported that they were sexually abused as children, how... From my understanding as an advocate and as a community member and as a woman, I understand that if you have trauma, what do you want to do? You want to take away the pain. If you're not receiving any kind of help, then some do go to alcohol, and some do go to drugs, and some do go to other things. And I'm not saying that is the best coping skill, but it's a coping skill that if that's what's in front of you, that's what you do. And then the truancy, how can you learn at school? Do you want to go to school to do everyday life if you're being raped at home?
This statistic was quite shocking even to Melissa Farley, who's done this research for many, many years, and said this is the highest rate of homelessness that she has seen in any community around the globe in over 15 years. 98% of the women that we interviewed were either currently or previously homeless. So you think about risk factors, and being homeless is certainly pretty high on that risk factor. And I'll tell you, if I'm homeless as a mother, as a mom, I'm going to do what I need to do to feed my kids. Bottom line, I'm going to do what it takes for me to survive and for my children to survive. And so these are the choices. This is how we look at it and go, well, it's a choice. She's an adult. She chose that. And these are the real choices. This is the real reality of what women are being faced with. So the federal definition of trafficking talks about, has language in there around force, fraud, or coercion, which is problematic in the fact that it puts the responsibility on the woman to prove that there was force, fraud, or coercion in order for trafficking to be prosecuted. But about half of the women met that conservative legal definition. And I want to point out that 92% of the women wanted to escape prostitution immediately. So I think it's important to remember that when we're thinking that it's a choice for her.
Were used by more than 200 sex buyers, and 16% had been used at least by 900 sex buyers. And most of the money that was used in prostitution didn't go for any kind of that. The women I spoke to didn't go for any kind of, you know, lavish this, lavish that. It was just like a place to stay. It was food to feed the kids. It was using it as a survival mechanism. And 42% of the pimps were gang affiliated. So there was some of that. There was some of being recruited and offered by other people in the community. So, and one of the quotes is, "I wouldn't say that there's pimps anymore. Now they're all boyfriends," and that really blurs the line for a lot of people. I mean, I know that if one of my personal boyfriends or my husband currently, that I wouldn't consider it a pimp, right? Because we have all these like stereotypes in our heads of what it looks like. We have like all these images on TV that helps portray who that might be. Anybody can be this. So anybody can be used in prostitution, man, woman, or child, elder status. Anybody can pimp another person out. So it doesn't, all those stereotypes are what we were kind of dealing with.
84% of the women that we interviewed had been physically assaulted, almost half by sex buyers, and a much smaller percentage by pimps. And I think that really speaks to more of how they're identifying pimps, because they're not calling their boyfriend their pimp. They really struggled with that terminology, and so that's why I think that number is so low. And then within the past month of being interviewed, 78% had been threatened with some type of weapon.
So, and one of the questions that we asked was the racism piece. 42% reported racial verbal abuse by pimps and buyers, and also other, like the sexual violence towards Native women, and some of them expressed the fetishes that some of the sex buyers would have. Because they were Native, they would specifically look for them either because they were Native or once they found out that they were Native, they were just trying to kind of do the girl's Pocahontas kind of thing, other scenarios. And the next slide is going to show, this is what one of the sex buyers had told one of the women.
This This is a quote that I think really, really sums up the hatred and the violence towards the women, and something that personally scared the heck out of me when I read this. And when I, this was not a woman that I interviewed, but when I read this quote, I just broke down sobbing, because it's scary to think that people are looking at you and your relatives and thinking, I thought we killed all of you. It's a pretty scary thought.
You know, just another piece of who we are. I mean, there's lots of different levels. As the Native community is trying to change, we're trying to change that. We're not mascots. We're not this. We're not a Halloween costume that you get to be. These are, you know. So we're always as Native people, we are objectified. There's lots of stereotypes that we're living high off this casino money. If that's the case, then how come so many of my sisters have to sell their body in order to feed their children? You know. So I just want to ask all of you in this audience that learn about who you live amongst. You know, learn about the tribes, learn about our histories, learn about our truths. Make an effort to do that.
The level of violence was extreme with the Native women that we interviewed. 92% had been raped while being used in prostitution. Again, 84% had been physically assaulted, and 72% of the women had traumatic brain injuries. And I don't know how many of you know anything about traumatic brain injuries, but it can have long-term permanent effects on your cognitive and developmental ability. And 72% of the women that we interviewed had traumatic brain injuries.
And as far as we're concerned, as a coalition, we understand that prostitution is paid rape. You know, there's like, to me, that's the stance that I take, and that's how I feel about it. That there's, I want to live in a world where I'm not raised that I have a commodity to give because somebody wants to benefit from it. And that's, we should all live in a community like that.
So this is our comparison of the Native women that we interviewed in Minnesota and a report that Melissa Farley published on a 9-country summary of women used in prostitution with over 800 women. So 854 women in her 9-country summary, and the 105 Native women that we interviewed here in Minnesota. And you can see how different these numbers are. The being threatened with a weapon, 78% compared to 64%. Being physically assaulted, 84% compared to 73%. Look at the rate of sexual assault, 92% compared to 57% in a 9-country summary of women around the globe. And then of those being raped more than 5 times, 68% of the women we interviewed here in Minnesota compared to 59%. The homelessness rate, 98% of the women that we interviewed, 75% in Melissa Farley's study. The being abused, physically abused, as a child was a little less, actually, but the sexual abuse was much higher, 79 compared to 63.
So these are the numbers of the disassociation of what they experienced, the flashbacks, spacing out, dizziness, memory problems. And this, all of these symptoms happened a lot of the times when we were talking with the women. You could totally tell when they just literally left. And I think that is a survival skill that we do, that we have, that is a gift. And that happens not just because you're used in prostitution. That can happen when things are the scariest for us and that we have to check out in order to kind of keep some kind of sanity within. And so I just think that it was... We wanted to honor that, and we wanted to validate them to say, you know, because they would apologize to say, oh, I'm sorry, what were we saying again? Okay, what was happening? And so it was really important to offer them any kind of, if we wanted some food and some water and our any kind of medicines, whether to smudge with sweetgrass or sage or whatever, and then offer them services beyond what we beyond the interview, to make sure that they were okay, that we weren't scraping off a wound and then sending them back into the community.
And these are some of the quotes from the women. I'm not going to read these. I'm just going to keep. We have 5 minutes, so the chronic health problems that the women were encountering was very long. So these are just some of them. Muscle aches and pains, memory problems, trouble concentrating, lots of headaches, stomach aches, joint pain. The mental health diagnosis were incredible. It was so many of the women had, it was almost odd how we would go to Bemidji and almost everybody had the same diagnosis. Then we'd go over to Duluth and everybody had the same diagnosis. So I don't know if they were going to the same doctor, but they certainly were dealing with the same types of effects. The problem with it is that they were being handed a lot of medication, not knowing how they counteracted with each other. And I think, you know, we really need to get better at how we respond to trauma. Because I think their number one issue was not ABC mental health diagnosis. It was, how do I respond to trauma? And until we get better at helping people work through that trauma, this is what we're going to have.
One of the Native women told us that I don't want to take any of these medicines anymore because it stops my dreams and that those are important to me. You know, as Native people, that's something that we're told to trust, that we get. Those are important messages that we have, and I think in a lot of cultures they are. So I remember her sharing that with me.
You want to go through that?
So here are the needs of what they had shared. Individual counseling, and then we compared it to the 9-country study as well. So I think that what shocked me was the legalized prostitution. When I asked some of the women that, they were just like, ew, what, why are you even asking me that? And so it was just to kind of get a feeling of what that is, because some people, you know, agree that it is it's work or, you know, liberation, whatever.
I think one thing that we heard time and time again from the women was that they wanted culturally relevant services for Native women. They wanted services by women, by Native women, for Native women. And they wanted people, they wanted advocates and services that were specifically tailored for women used in prostitution, because they didn't want to feel like they had to go to a program and educate the advocate on their experience or on how to help them.
Because as Native or women in general, we can be really gross and mean to each other. And so if you put a woman used in prostitution in a shelter for battered women, that kind of like, oh, you nasty. Oh, because I'm better because I didn't have to do that. Those kinds of things do happen, right? And so we want to keep our victims safe and having them have a safe place to live.
And so we also asked women what services did they access. And we were shocked to know that very few of them had gone to a sexual assault program. Myself being a sexual assault advocate, that says something to me. And so to me that says we need to get better at providing that outreach. We need to get better at providing those services and to educate ourselves. Because women don't know that we're a service for them. And we need to have all of our literature and material say that we identify prostitution and trafficking as a form of sexual violence, and to be offering those services to women. I already talked about that. We're going to go through these fast. These are the recommendations that came out of it. Clearly we need an increase in funding to help with some of these services, housing, advocacy programs specifically for Native victims of trafficking. We need more access to physical and mental health care. And I would add that one thing that we also heard loud and clear was they wanted that connection to our ceremonies and to our culture and a safe access. And so it's not always mental health care. They want that spiritual side as well.
We need reducing the arrests of our women. Let's flip the script. Let's think outside of the box and start asking our men, why is it okay to buy a woman in prostitution? Why is it okay to buy a child used in prostitution? Why are societies feeling like that is something that is acceptable, that is okay to do, and it's a rite of passage, passage in some dialogues and some ways of thinking, and it's not okay. We need to start ending the demand.
And if you want to learn more about the demand side of it, Melissa Farley has also done extensive research with sex buyers and has published that on her website, which is prostitutionresearch.com. I'm going to just skip through this and end with this before I open it up for questions. This is from the very first woman that we interviewed. Her name was Violet. We need someone to understand where we came from and how we lived, and that half of us were raped, beat, and made to sell our bodies. We need people with hearts. So then I'm going to put up these are our websites. So I'd like to open it up now for questions. Questions or comments or... Yes. We have sent this report to some people. We haven't done it on a real large scale. Sarah Deer testified at the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs hearing and talked about some of these. It was right before our report was published, so she gave some of the data, but not the full data. But we have since sent a copy of the report to many members of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs and also to... Senator Al Franken has been very responsive, and he, in fact, sent a video message that was played at the release of our report. We did our best to connect them with their local resources, and we also invited all of them to come to our coalition meetings and to connect with other advocates and other people and other Native women around the state of Minnesota. And some of them have done that. Some of them we haven't heard from again. Some of them have come back a year later and said that it really helped for them to say it out loud, and they have since gotten out of prostitution. So it varies person to person, but we did try to connect them to resources.
Well, I can't imagine that if I was a mother and I got diagnosed, if somebody wanted to put a case against me, that I'd get my children. And I don't know of, like, we know enough about that. We're not, you know, we're still in our society still looking as prostitution as a work, as a employment, and that you know, there's a lot of... It's not a woman-friendly kind of... It's all based on, like, this criminalization of women and not so much of men. I mean, there's a pot of money in St. Paul where if a man gets picked up for soliciting a woman for sex, whether it's on the internet or on the street, there is, like, it's called the John Pot or something like that. The John Fund, and currently, when I last looked, because I went to a John school where Breaking Free does this education, a full-day education for perpetrators who are soliciting women for sex, there was, like, no money in there. But there's all kinds of women that are incarcerated for being used in prostitution. So we're looking at it as a different view, and I think that it's just easy to... always blame that person and saying, oh, what did you do wrong? How did you get into that? You know? But there's always things that lead into why did I, you know, the PTSD piece and whatever. So I think that, I don't know.
I think it'll certainly be another way to dismiss us and to not validate that woman, but to further call, you know, label her and further the harm. Jurisdiction?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and that could actually be a class here on tribal jurisdiction, because it's very complex. But to sum it up, tribes have no jurisdiction over non-Indian offenders. So if a non-Indian offender goes to the reservation and rapes a Native woman or a Native child, the tribe has no jurisdiction over him.
Or comes and traffics a person out of the reservation.
Right. And so oftentimes what had been happening in the past was the feds don't pick it up. We're a public law 280 state, so only so most of our tribes are under, they have concurrent jurisdiction with the state, except for Red Lake and Boys Fort. They're non-PL 280, and so the federal government has concurrent jurisdiction with them over major crimes. So if that non-Indian offender trafficked a woman on Red Lake, it would be at the federal government's discretion as to whether they wanted to prosecute that crime. And what we have seen in the past was that oftentimes they have not responded.
To just sexual assault, not even talking about prostitution, so...
Yes, and our research showed that the men who buy Native women and the men who are selling Native women are primarily non-Native men. We do. We do, and it's all in the full report that you could access on our website. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Right, so sometimes they were couch hopping, sometimes they were on the street. I talked to one woman who, her mother had been in a domestic violence situation, and so she went to a battered women's shelter, but because the daughter was an adult child, she was 19, the battered women's shelter would not allow her to stay there, so then she was homeless. Her mom had a place to stay, she was homeless. I met other people who just did not have housing. They were literally couch hopping from friends.
Staying at homeless shelters.
Or staying in homeless shelters.
Which are very dangerous for women. I mean, yeah, there's lots of, you know, you get a lot of everybody there, so it's a pretty dangerous spot to stay.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They came forward.
They were self-selected. So we, in the metro area, we reached out to a couple service providers that worked with women used in prostitution and trafficking. And once word got out on the street, we were literally getting 5 and 6 phone calls a day. And in the Bemidji area and Duluth, the advocates there reached out to some of the social service organizations and homeless shelters, and they put up flyers. And then the women just called in.
And we had to change our flyers, too, because, well, originally we had, if you've ever been used in prostitution or trafficked. And so when we had that language, nobody was coming for the first round, and we had to put it out, and we said, have you ever exchanged sex asks for A, B, C, D, you know, whatever. And then they started coming because in our tribal communities, prostitution has a different look to it. It doesn't look like it would be like street prostitution that you would probably see in the inner city. It with like, you know, dressed a certain way or maybe like, you know, in a certain environment. And so that feeling of what it looked like was different. So we had to
We have a lot of stereotypes about what prostitution looks like, so we really had to define it and explain it.
We are officially out of time, but we urge all of you, you're all invited to the American Indian Center for a reception, and you'll stay for like 10 minutes to
answer questions. Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.